Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 185, Fall Bounty. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. You can find out more from the Knitting Out Loud catalog at knittingoutloud.com. Also, Knit Circus magazine featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can see more of Knit Circus magazine at www.knitcircus.com. Also, Scribe Tutor, the online writing tutor offering personalized and convenient writing help for all ages. You can see more at scribetutor.com. Well, hello! It's a lovely fall morning here, which means that it's still under 70 degrees outside. Shocking. Our fall has been odd, but, you know, the weather here has been odd for a while. I think as everything kind of warms up, the extremes are getting more extreme. So lack of rain will be more extreme here, and when we do get rain, it's more extreme. More microbursts. I don't know if you have microbursts where you are. They're like mini tornadoes that touch down. When we first moved here, I think we had a microburst wipe out an entire tree, which, you know, in the desert is saying something because the trees here are tenacious. My husband likes to say when he goes out to garden that this is the only place he's ever lived where the plants actually fight back when you try to trim them. And it's true. They do. He comes in and he's completely ripped up and he wears Teflon gloves. So if you have any glove recommendations that are stronger than the Teflon coated drugs. He needs the drugs after wearing the gloves. No, if you have good recommendations, please put them in the show notes so that everybody can share in the bounty of your knowledge, because it's a real problem. You know, these little tiny prickers, and oh, it's awful, 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 awful. But we are indeed experiencing a fall bounty here. I have been canning and putting up food and cooking. I made a crustless pumpkin pie, which I was very happy with, that I think came out quite well. And all sorts of jams and jellies, more than the last time I talked to you. I made a killer chicken soup and then took that and some of the broth and made a killer risotto. I picked up some arborio rice, just bulk, at, what is it, Whole Foods? It used to be something else. Wild Oats. Now it's Whole Foods. And I was moved by Tanya, Brenda's Tanya, who made a killer risotto when I was back there. So I had to kind of scratch my risotto itch, as it were. And you know, if you're listening to a book on tape or a podcast or something, standing there and stirring the risotto is really not as onerous as it is when you're not. I've been listening. I have an Audible subscription and I will use my monthly credit to get some really radically expensive book. But I otherwise go to their free download section, and I discovered a new podcaster. I'm going to put a link to his podcast. It's Classic Tales Podcast. And I downloaded two of his Jeeves, you know, P.G. Wodehouse episodes. And I thought to myself, well, this is either going to be a wonderful British man who's doing this and they're going to be lovely and funny, or this is going to be a debacle. And he's an American. And the first Jeeves that I listened to, the opening was kind of wobbly, but he really hit his stride. And then the second Jeeves story that I downloaded, they were wonderful. And I think his downloads are 99 cents. They're not a lot. I'm trying to remember. But I was impressed. So that was a nice new find, kind of an accidental find. And then I also downloaded a bunch of the casebooks of Sherlock Holmes, which are collections of the BBC radio plays of Sherlock Holmes, which are just marvelous. I really, well, you know that I love listening to things read out loud, But radio plays done by people who really know what they're doing are just wonderful. And as a consequence of listening to that, I listened to A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when my older son was around. So he's now hooked and he's about to start the Sherlock Holmes. He's very excited about that. But I will put links to all of this stuff up. Yeah, Audible isn't the cheapest thing in the world. And I'm still kind of irked sometimes at how expensive it can be. But I do have to say that the quality of the books that they offer is lovely. And now that they have the free section, for someone like me who really can only afford the one book a month, I at least can go on and get some other stuff. So that was fun. Oh, and back with the cooking thing. If you are planning a Thanksgiving meal, if you're in the States and you're planning a Thanksgiving meal and you have just learned that some poor schmo who's coming to your meal is gluten intolerant, I have happy news for you. Bisquick now has a gluten-free Bisquick mix. I know, right? I mean, that changes everything. That's a game changer. Because if you can make anything with Bisquick, you can now make it gluten-free with Bisquick. And I'm relieved. I'm as bad as it is, I'm kind of glad that I didn't know I couldn't eat gluten 5 or 6 years ago, because there was a real wasteland. And now, you know, the creepy thing is now I'm reading more and more women who are coming up and saying, you know, I just found out I can't eat gluten. I just found out I can't have this. It's all right during or after a pregnancy. And my husband kept saying, you know, what is it that's changing in you? I mean, aside from your love, you know, what is it that's your body's altering somehow that's making it no longer able to process this food? And in fact, if you have gone totally autoimmune, then what is it that's making your body attack itself? So, one of our scientific types who's out there maybe will clue us in on some of the science behind how something like this could happen, because it is kind of weird, you know? The other good news about Thanksgiving is it looks like we will be able to go to New York and have Thanksgiving with my husband's fantastic cousins and my brother and sister-in-law, which means I get a crafty Thanksgiving. It's all very, very, very good. And I'm hoping that your Thanksgivings are shaping up as well. It is, you know, a stressful month. What with NaNoWriMo, NaNoWriMo.com or .org. I can't remember. It's one of the two. Anyway, yes, there will be another novel. Someday I'm going to sell one of these. I figure if I just keep churning them out, eventually I'll get there. I learned a lot. I have learned a lot over the last, 4 or 5 years of doing this. I recommend it. Arbitrary deadlines. If you've ever wanted to write anything, really, really good. I am, I believe, Mama O or Mama O Knits on the NaNoWriMo thing. Anyway, you can friend me. I'll put a link to my NaNoWriMo page, and that way you can get the number and you can friend me that way. And then I'll be able to keep track of what you're doing too, and it's very fun. Crafty wise, I mean, aside from the cooking, which is crafty, I have been knitting up a storm. I finished knitting one thing that I designed for an upcoming book. As soon as they release the information on these books, I will be able to tell you more about them. But they've asked me to hold off until they have their stuff. I can tell you that one of them, the first one, is coming out in June or July of 2011. So that's coming. That'll come out after the Madame Defarge book. And the Madame Defarge thing is the other piece that I'm knitting. I've designed all of my other pieces. The last one I have is the Madame Defarge shawl. And I've done all the prototyping, and now I am knitting the actual thing from the charts. And I'm quite excited. I had to come up with, if I do say so myself, a rather clever workaround to a problem that many shawls have. And if this works as brilliantly as I think it will, then it's actually going to be a solution you can use with other shawls. You can take it and transpose it, as it were, to other knitting endeavors. So I'm very excited about that. I am also excited to let you know that I totally stumbled across something that you may well already know about, but I didn't. Something called Zen Tangles. So it looks like Zentacles, but it's Zen, mindful thought, calm, peaceful, mindful thought, and Tangle, which is usually not calm and peaceful. And the idea is this. You have a small piece of paper, maybe 4x4, maybe 3x3. I've been using the art cards, even though they're not square. The Zen Tangle people prefer square. I'm sure it's more Zen, universal, angle, something. But I have the little $2 art card. So you take your art card and you put 4 dots, one in each corner. And then you use a pencil and you connect the dots. And you can do squigglies, you can do wavies, you can do straight lines, you can do anything. Then you start manipulating the space inside the frame that you just drew for yourself. I'm going to put up links to the main Zentangle page, and I will tell you this. They recommend that you purchase a $49 Zentangle kit. Now, if you have $49 to blow on this, rock on and Godspeed, because that's way out of my budget right now. However, the good people at Zentangles also have Zentangle newsletters, and in the back issues, you can see examples. So if you are a do-it-yourselfer who maybe doesn't really want the kit with all of the instructions and the CDs and the paper, if you just kind of want to play, do what I did and go through the newsletters and discover these wonderful patterns. So the idea, the Zen part of this, is that mindfully putting lines on paper is a wonderful calming way to clear the mind. We talk about this with knitting all the time, ad infinitum, to the point where non-knitters are really ready to hurl. We also talk about this kind of thing with Tai Chi, moving meditation. Well, the Zentangle thing seems to be taking a page from that book. And the idea is, if you, especially if you are a doodler and you doodle kind of mindlessly, you can now doodle mindfully and come out with this really kickin' art. Not everybody's are brilliant genius, hardly, but the main woman who does these, she does a gorgeous job. I mean, hers really are works of art. And she's done things like, I think there's an example of somebody painted the bathroom floor white, like, you know, nice shiny white. And then she went in with a marker and Zentangled part of the floor. They've Zentangled part of walls. They've Zentangled around holes in walls. And I have a hole in a closet door that needs some kind of help. And now I'm thinking, I wonder if it's possible to take that and artify it. So there's lots of really interesting things. And if you, I am not a doodler, but my husband is, and my kids are. So I kind of introduced this at lunch one time. I always take the art cards and a little pocket watercolor set and the water pens, the paintbrushes that have water in a reservoir so that you always have water no matter where you are. I always take these when we go out to lunch or to dinner because, you know, kids get fidgety, and honestly, so do I. So now we had kind of a focus on ways to use those cards, and it really got some interesting stuff out of the kids. I was very impressed, and my husband as well. He is a silly doodler, but I like his stuff. It looks like James Thurber to me. So that was the last crafty thing, and I have a question. I am posing a question to you, and it goes like this. As I am continuing on building the online business and working on this blasted search engine optimization thing, the SEO stuff, I have learned something about all of you. And what I have learned is this. Apparently, none of you found this podcast by accident. The only people who appear to come to Craftlit come deliberately by looking up the name Craftlit, or just typing in craftlit.com, or by clicking a link from other show notes, whether it's Knitting Rose or Knit a Journey or Cast On or Weave Cast, any of those. Nobody accidentally finds this by searching for, say, free audiobook podcast or anything like that. So my question is this. If you did stumble on this show, please post in the website show notes, craftlit.com show notes. Please post how you did it. How did you find this accidentally? Because right now the technology that's available shows none at all on the kind of accidental stumble thing. So, curious, no? Huh. Means you all chose to be here. How very zen of you. But, you know, really today, all of this is just an elaborate way of avoiding scrapbooking my stuff that I brought back from the trip. I had grand plans of scrapbooking, you know, and not like classy scrapbooking, because I can't do that. I've tried. I am not that kind of scrapbooker. What I like to do is get a really good sketchbook and then do something on the cover and then, you know, paste stuff in and draw stuff on and kind of create my own goofy scrapbook. And I'm afraid right now because I brought back so many scraps of paper and pieces of things and stories and pictures and stuff. So I am going to have to just bite the bullet at some point and get this thing done. But you know, talking to you means I don't have to start. So I'll just talk to you about Mark Twain for a little bit, shall I? Well, this week, I promised you last week, this week starts to change the game a bit. Next week's two chapters are a little bit more like the episodic stuff that you've heard before. But today, you know, we've been leading up to some big telling moment. The boss and the king are on their quest, and it's not a real quest. It's just kind of a journey for the king to learn more about his people, learn about his kingdom a little bit from a different perspective. And of course, the boss is having a very difficult time accomplishing this because, you know, contextually, the king was theoretically raised to be the king, and so always kind of saw things from that point of view. And, you know, we've talked about this before, that one of the theories about why Elizabeth I was such a kick-in monarch was because she really wasn't raised that way. She kind of didn't ever expect to be queen. And while she wasn't a commoner, you know, at all, she was not coddled, perhaps is the right word, the way if you see the movie Young Victoria, you know, the poor woman wasn't allowed to walk up or down a staircase by herself for fear that something untoward would happen. It's a different kind of thing for Elizabeth I. Well, Arthur, you know, depending on whether you go with the T.H. White version, which of course wasn't written when Mark Twain was writing, if you go with The Sword and the Stone, then he was raised in obscurity to be allowed to discover the things that the boss is trying to teach him right now. And you know, the stories of King Arthur are legion and buried in the mists of time. I mean, you go back to, you know, Geoffrey of Monmouth or Malory, and, you know, you're still hundreds of years out from when any of this may have happened. Now, my understanding is that people now accept that there was an Arthur. He was a tribal chieftain. The one thing that I remember from my Arthurian class, which I probably have said before, is that there was no great love between the Romans and the Celts, which makes sense, occupiers and occupied. However, there is a moment in time, and I think it's around 700 AD somewhere, where all of a sudden there are all these Celtic children being born named Artos, which means the bear, which is related to Arthur, which is a Roman name. Now, that's what I learned in my class. That was 20 years ago. There may be new information out there, but I do remember there being kind of a pivotal change in naming, and that was a key, that something had happened, and someone had influenced everybody so much that they were willing to name their children after a Roman name, thus indicating that perhaps there was a Roman warlord who was able to unify the Celts. This, of course, would have been long after Rome technically left. I mean, you know, Hadrian built his wall and then it all kind of, Roman Empire kind of fell apart. So what, 100 years after that? I have to look up when Hadrian was. I saw his wall, not on this trip, but before. It's pretty impressive. If you have a chance, if you are ever in England and have the opportunity to drive north, please do. There are some parts of the wall where it's invisible. You know, it's been worried down to the ground, but there are parts of it that are really still quite significant. Impressive architecture. Hadrian's villa outside of Rome, also worth seeing. All right, so that was a little Roman detour. Anyway, there, the Arthur that Twain is utilizing in this story does appear to be someone who was raised to be royal and not have any personal knowledge of the way the normal people live. He does have his the king's eval, where he, you know, is helping, quote unquote, the people who come to petition for aid, and that's all well and good, but it leaves a rather large gap as far as the boss is concerned in Arthur's education. And this is also where Twain's talent as a storyteller starts to get away from him and starts to foreshadow where things are going a little bit more directly. Because, you know, obviously, this book is promoted as being a comedy. And oh, isn't it funny how this guy, the boss, goes swatting around all of England thinking that he's all that and a slice of bread, and yet he is utilizing the same techniques and the same lies, for lack of a better word, in order to accomplish his goals. And his assumption, of course, being a 19th century white male in that time period, is clearly that he's right. Of course he's right. I mean, duh. So there are a couple things you need to know about Twain. I don't know if you're familiar with King Leopold. I am not hugely versed in King Leopold, so I'm only going to give you enough information to go out and find out more on your own, because it would be a real sideline. If you did see Young Victoria, however, you heard about Leopold. Leopold was active in Africa. He was a king. I think he was a Belgian king. Yes, because it was the Belgian Congo that he was messing about in. He was, well, if you take the boss and his attitudes towards the people of the time that he finds himself in, and you amplify them and magnify them and give him weapons, you get Leopold in the Congo. This is my understanding. There's a book that my husband read years ago called Leopold's Ghost, or King Leopold's Ghost. Twain wrote a piece on King Leopold, and you know what? If I can find it, I'm going to link to it so you can read. Because you'll be surprised. It's Twain being political, which is not a surprise, but it's Twain being angry political. He's furious about what is happening in Africa to the Africans. And, you know, this is right around the time Conrad's doing Heart of Darkness, and you've got Twain doing this. And I'm sure you are well aware now, anytime something comes up that resonates with American slavery, you're going to hear more of that today. But there is also this other element of what was happening, the imperialism that was happening out of Europe and throughout various parts of the world, certainly in India and Africa. And Twain was ticked. And so when he has the boss galumphing about and pushing people around and being, you know, quite proud of it, you're supposed to be horrified. In fact, Josie posted a comment that she was surprised that Americans got irony. And actually, Josie, the sad thing is a lot don't. a lot of Americans don't get irony. And therefore, they think that when Twain is saying something like this, that that is his opinion and his pro opinion, you know, like he's pro the boss and thinks that what the boss is doing is good. Well, it will become clearer where Twain actually sits in all of this as we continue to finish the book. But you will start to see today what happens when the boss is actually broadsided and surprised himself by King Arthur. And, you know, maybe it's just, you know, the time of the month when AT&T commercials make me cry or something. But I know when I first listened to this, and then when I second listened to this, and when I third listened to this, it did bring tears to my eyes. It's one of those moments that reminds you that Twain can really write, and that there is probably a purpose underneath all of the wordplay and the silliness. So, chapter 29, the first chapter we listened to today, 29 is the sadder of the two. Chapter 30 is also melancholy, but for a different reason. And it's one more of these places where Twain, whether something like this really would have happened politically and legally in England in the 6th century is not Twain's business. This kind of thing, what you hear happening in 30, chapter 30, is what happened in the American South during slavery. And it's, you know, it's just another one of those parallels that he's drawing. But I also think that Twain knows his history enough to know that the progress that men made, and I use the term politically, because women were certainly involved too, but the progress that men made over time towards democracy and republic, you know, kind of working our way back after Athens went by the way, and as we moved into more modern versions, post-Enlightenment, of democracy, of republic, of self-governance, Twain tried to keep present in our minds what life would have been like without our modern understanding of self-governance. And I think he does a very good job at a very difficult task, which is to both allow us to be horrified by the way things are, but also understand it, and to walk away being able to say, not just, wow, I'm glad things aren't like that anymore, but more importantly, wow, it's really important that we don't let things go back to being that. Remember, Twain was writing, this is one of his later books, and this is the era of the robber barons. This is when the discrepancy between rich and poor was enormous in the United States. I don't actually know if it was the same all over the world, but in the English-speaking world, the distance between rich and poor was pretty massive, both in America and in England. And I think he's trying very hard to remind us of how lucky we are. And I can't think of a more timely time to be reading the book, actually, now that I think about it. So, first some sad, then some curious, and then next week we get back to some silly. So I will now let you listen to chapters 29 and 30 of
A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, chapter 29, The Smallpox Hut. When we arrived at that hut at mid-afternoon, we saw no signs of life about it. The field nearby had been denuded of its crop some time before, and had a skinned look, so exhaustively had it been harvested and gleaned. Fences, sheds, everything had a ruined look, and were eloquent of poverty. No animal was around anywhere, no living thing in sight. The stillness was awful. It was like the stillness of death. The cabin was a one-story one whose thatch was black with age and ragged from lack of repair. The door stood a trifle ajar. We approached it stealthily, on tiptoe and at half-breath, for that is the way one's feeling makes him do at such a time. The king knocked. We waited. No answer. Knocked again. No answer. I pushed the door softly open and looked in. I made out some dim forms, and a woman started up from the ground and stared at me, as one does who is awakened from sleep. Presently she found her voice.
"Have mercy," she pleaded. "All is taken. Nothing is left."
"I have not come to take anything, poor woman."
"You are not a priest?"
"No."
"Nor come not from the lord of the manor?"
"No, I am a stranger."
"Oh, then, for the fear of God, who visits with misery and death such as be harmless, tarry not here, but fly. This place is under his curse and his church's."
"Let me come in and help you. You are sick and in trouble." I was better used to the dim light now. I could see her hollow eyes fixed upon me. I could see how emaciated she was.
"I tell you, the place is under the church's ban. Save yourself and go before some straggler see thee here and report it."
"Give yourself no trouble about me. I don't care anything for the church's curse. Let me help you."
"Now, all good spirits, if there be any such, bless thee for that word. Would God I had a sup of water. But hold, forget I said it, and fly, for there is that here that even he that feareth not the church must fear, this disease whereof we die. Leave us, thou brave good stranger, and take with thee such whole and sincere blessing as them that be accursed can give."
But before this I had picked up a wooden bowl and was rushing past the king on my way to the brook. It was 10 yards away. When I got back and entered, the king was within, and was opening the shutter that closed the window hole to let in air and light. The place was full of a foul stench. I put the bowl to the woman's lips, and as she gripped it with her eager talons, the shutter came open, and a strong light flooded her face. Smallpox! I sprang to the king and said in his ear, "Out of the door on the instant, sire! The woman is dying of that disease that wasted the skirts of Camelot 2 years ago." He did not budge. "Of a truth, I shall remain, and likewise help." I whispered again, "King, it must not be. You must go." "Ye mean well, and ye speak not unwisely, but it were shame that a king should know fear, and shame that belted knight should withhold his hand where be such as need succor. Peace, I will not go. It is you who must go. The church's ban is not upon me, but it forbiddeth you to be here, and she will deal with you with a heavy hand, and word come to her of your trespass." It was a desperate place for him to be in, and might cost him his life, but it was no use to argue with him. If he considered his knightly honor at stake here, that was the end of argument. He would stay, and nothing could prevent it. I was aware of that, and so I dropped the subject. The woman spoke.
"Fair sir, of your kindness, will ye climb the ladder there and bring me news of what ye find? Be not afraid to report, for times can come when even a mother's heart is past breaking, being already broke."
"Abide," said the king, "and give the woman to eat. I will go," and he put down the knapsack. I turned to start, but the king had already started. He halted and looked down upon a man who lay in a dim light and had not noticed us thus far or spoken. "Is this your husband?" the king asked.
"Yes."
"Is he asleep?"
"God be thanked for that one charity, yes, these 3 hours. Where shall I pay to the full my gratitude, for my heart is bursting with it for that sleep he sleepeth now?"
I said, "We will be careful. We will not wake him."
"Ah, no, that ye will not, for he is dead."
"Dead?"
"Yes, what triumph it is to know it. None can harm him, none insult him more. He is in heaven now, and happy. Or, if not there, he abides in hell and is content, for in that place he will find neither abbot nor yet bishop. We were boy and girl together. We were man and wife these 25 years, and never separated till this day. Think how long that is to love and suffer together. This morning was he out of his mind, and in his fancy we were boy and girl again, and wandering in the happy fields. And so in that innocent-clad converse wandered he far and farther, still lightly gossiping, and entered into those other fields we know not of, and was shut away from mortal sight. And so there was no parting, for in his fancy I went with him. He knew not, but I went with him, my hand in his, my young soft hand, not this withered claw. Ah, yes, to go and know it not, to separate and know it not. How could one go peacefuller than that? It was his reward for a cruel life patiently borne.
There was a slight noise from the direction of the dim corner where the ladder was. It was the king descending. I could see that he was bearing something in one arm and assisting himself with the other. He came forward into the light. Upon his breast lay a slender girl of 15. She was but half conscious. She was dying of smallpox. Here was heroism and its last and loftiest possibility, its utmost summit. This was challenging death in the open field, unarmed, with all the odds against the challenger, no reward set upon the contest, and no admiring world in silks and cloth of gold to gaze and applaud. And yet the king's bearing was as serenely brave as it had always been in those cheaper contests where knight meets knight in equal fight and clothed in protecting steel. He was great now, sublimely great. The rude statues of his ancestors in his palace should have an addition. I would see to that. And it would not be a mailed king killing a giant or a dragon like the rest. It would be a king in commoner's garb bearing death in his arms, that a peasant mother might look her last upon her child and be comforted. He laid the girl down by her mother, who poured out endearments and caresses from an overflowing heart. And one could detect a flickering faint light of response in the child's eyes, but that was all. The mother hung over her, kissing her, petting her, and imploring her to speak, but the lips only moved and no sound came. I snatched my liquor flask from my knapsack, and the woman forbade me and said, "No, she does not suffer. It is better so. It might bring her back to life. None that be so good and kind as ye are would do her that cruel hurt. For look you, what is left to live for? Her brothers are gone, her father is gone, her mother goeth, the church's curse is upon her, and none may shelter or befriend her, even though she lay perishing in the road. She is desolate. I have not asked you, good heart, if her sister be still on live. Here, overhead, I had no need. Ye had gone back, else, and not left the poor thing forsaken." "She lieth at peace," interrupted the king in a subdued voice.
"I would not change it. How rich is this day in happiness! Ah, my Annis, thou shalt join thy sister soon. Thou art on thy way, and these be merciful friends that will not hinder."
And so she fell to murmuring and cooing over the girl again, and softly stroking her face and hair, and kissing her, and calling her by endearing names. But there was scarcely sign of response now in the glazing eyes. I saw tears well from the king's eyes, and trickle down his face. The woman noticed them too, and said,
"Ah, I know that sign. Thou'st a wife at home, poor soul, and you and she have gone hungry to bed many's the time, that the little ones might have your crust. You know what poverty is, and the daily insults of your betters, and the heavy hand of the church and the king."
The king winced under this accidental home shot, but kept still. He was learning his part, and he was playing it well, too, for a pretty dull beginner. I struck up a diversion. I offered the woman food and liquor, but she refused both. She would allow nothing to come between her and the release of death. Then I slipped away and brought the dead child from aloft and laid it by her. This broke her down again, and there was another scene that was full of heartbreak. By and by I made another diversion and beguiled her to sketch her story.
"Ye know it well yourselves, having suffered it, for truly none of our condition in Britain escape it. It is the old weary tale. We fought and struggled and succeeded, meaning by success that we lived and did not die. More than that is not to be claimed. No troubles came that we could not outlive, till this year brought them. Then came they all at once, as one might say, and overwhelmed us. Years ago the lord of the manor planted certain fruit trees on our farm, in the best part of it too, a grievous wrong and shame.
But it was his right, interrupted the king.
None denieth that, indeed. And the law mean anything, what is the lord's is his, and what is mine is his also. Our farm was ours by lease, therefore 'twas likewise his to do with as he would. Some little time ago, three of those trees were found hewn down. Our three grown sons ran frightened to report the crime. Well, in his lordship's dungeon there they lie, who saith there shall they lie and rot till they confess. They have naught to confess, being innocent. Wherefore, there will they remain until they die. Ye know that right well, I ween. Think how this left us, a man, a woman, and two children, to gather a crop that was planted by so much greater force, yes, and protected night and day from pigeons and prowling animals that be sacred and must not be hurt by any of our sort. When my lord's crop was nearly ready for the harvest, so also was ours. When his bell rang to call us to his fields to harvest his crop for nothing, he would not allow that I and my two girls should count for our three captive sons, but for only two of them. So for the lacking one were we daily fined. All this time our own crop was perishing through neglect, and so both the priest and his lordship fined us, because their shares of it were suffering through damage. In the end the fines ate up our crop, and they took it all. They took it all and made us harvest it for them without pay or food, and we are starving. Then the worst came when I, being out of my mind with hunger and loss of my boys, and grief to see my husband and my little maids in rags and misery and despair, uttered a deep blasphemy, oh, a thousand of them, against the church and the church's ways. It was 10 days ago. I had fallen sick with this disease, and it was to the priest I said the words, for he was come to chide me for lack of due humility under the chastening hand of God. He carried my trespass to his betters. I was stubborn, wherefore presently upon my head and upon all heads that were dear to me fell the curse of Rome.
End of chapter 29. Chapter 30. The Tragedy of the Manor House. At midnight all was over, and we sat in the presence of four corpses. We covered them with such rags as we could find, and started away, fastening the door behind us. Their home must be these people's grave, for they could not have Christian burial, or be admitted to consecrated ground. They were as dogs, wild beasts, lepers, and no soul that valued its hope of eternal life would throw it away by meddling in any sort with these rebuked and smitten outcasts. We had not moved four steps when I caught a sound as of footsteps upon gravel. My heart flew to my throat. We must not be seen coming from that house. I plucked at the king's robe, and we drew back and took shelter behind a corner of the cabin. "Now we are safe," I said, "but it was a close call, so to speak. If the night had been lighter, he might have seen us, no doubt. He seemed to be so near."
"Mayhap it is but a beast and not a man at all."
"True, but man or beast, it would be wise to stay here a minute and let it get by and out of the way."
"Hark! It cometh hither."
True again. The step was coming toward us, straight toward the hut. It must be a beast then, and we might as well have saved our trepidation. I was going to step out, but the king laid his hand upon my arm. There was a moment of silence, then we heard a soft knock on the cabin door. It made me shiver. Presently the knock was repeated, and then we heard these words in a guarded voice.
"Mother, father, open! We have got free, and we bring news to pale your cheeks but glad your hearts, and we may not tarry but must fly, and... but they answer not. Mother, father!"
I drew the king toward the other end of the hut and whispered, "Come,
Now we can get to the road.
The king hesitated, was going to demur, but just then we heard the door give way and knew that those desolate men were in the presence of their dead.
Come, my liege, in a moment they will strike a light, and then will follow that which it would break your heart to hear.
He did not hesitate this time. The moment we were in the road, I ran, and after a moment he threw dignity aside and followed. I did not want to think of what was happening in the hut. I couldn't bear it. I wanted to drive it out of my mind, so I struck into the first subject that lay under that one in my mind.
I have had the disease those people died of, and so have nothing to fear, but if you have not had it also...
He broke in upon me to say he was in trouble, and it was his conscience that was troubling him.
These young men have got free, they say, but how? It is not likely that their lord hath set them free.
Oh, no, I make no doubt they escaped.
That is my trouble. I have a fear that this is so, and your suspicion doth confirm it, you having the same fear.
I should not call it by that name, though. I do suspect that they escaped, but if they did, I am not sorry, certainly.
I am not sorry, I think, but...
What is it? What is there for one to be troubled about?
If they did escape, then are we bound in duty to lay hands upon them and deliver them again to their lord? For it is not seemly that one of his quality should suffer a so insolent and high-handed outrage from persons of their base degree.
There it was again. He could see only one side of it. He was born so, educated so. His veins were full of ancestral blood that was rotten with this sort of unconscious brutality, brought down by inheritance from a long procession of hearts that had each done its share toward poisoning the stream. To imprison these men without proof and starve their kindred was no harm, for they were merely peasants and the subject to the will and pleasure of their lord, no matter what fearful form it might take. But for these men to break out of unjust captivity was insult and outrage, and a thing not to be countenanced by any conscientious person who knew his duty to his sacred caste. I worked more than half an hour before I got him to change the subject, and even then an outside matter did it for me. This was a something which caught our eyes as we struck the summit of a small hill, a red glow, a good way off.
"That's a fire," said I.
Fires interested me considerably, because I was getting a good deal of insurance business started, and was also training some horses and building some steam fire engines with an eye to be a paid fire department by and by. The priests opposed both my fire and life insurance on the ground that it was an insolent attempt to hinder the decrees of God, and if you pointed out that they did not hinder the decrees in the least, but only modified the hard consequences of them, if you took out policies and had luck, they retorted that that was gambling against the decrees of God, and was just as bad. So they managed to damage those industries more or less, but I got even on my accident business. As a rule, a knight is a lummox, and sometimes even a labrick, and hence open to pretty poor arguments when they come glibly from a superstition monger. But even he could see the practical side of a thing once in a while, and so of late you couldn't clean up a tournament and pile the result without finding one of my accident tickets in every helmet. We stood there a while, in the thick darkness and stillness, looking toward the red blur in the distance, and trying to make out the meaning of a far-away murmur that rose and fell fitfully on the night. Sometimes it swelled up and for a moment seemed less remote, but when we were hopefully expecting it to betray its cause and nature, it dulled and sank again, carrying its mystery with it. We started down the hill in its direction, and the winding road plunged us at once into almost solid darkness, darkness that was packed and crammed in between two tall forest walls. We groped along down for half a mile, perhaps, that murmur growing more and more distinct all the time. The coming storm threatening more and more, with now and then a little shiver of wind, a faint show of lightning, and dull grumblings of distant thunder. I was in the lead. I ran against something, a soft, heavy something, which gave slightly to the impulse of my weight. At the same moment the lightning glared out, and within a foot of my face was the writhing face of a man who was hanging from the limb of a tree. That is, it seemed to be writhing, but it was not. It was a gruesome sight. Straightway there was an ear-splitting explosion of thunder, and the bottom of heaven fell out,
The rain poured down in a deluge. No matter, we must try to cut this man down on the chance that there might be life in him yet, mustn't we? The lightning came quick and sharp now, and the place was alternately noonday and midnight. One moment the man would be hanging before me in an intense light, and the next he was blotted out again in the darkness. I told the king we must cut him down. The king at once objected. If he hanged himself, he was willing to lose him property to his lord, so let him be. If others hanged him, belike they had the right. Let him hang. But me no buts, but even leave him as he is. And for yet another reason. When the lightning cometh again, there, look abroad. Two others hanging within 50 yards of us. It is not weather meet for doing useless courtesies unto dead folk. They are past thanking you. Come, it is unprofitable to tarry here. There was reason in what he said, so we moved on. Within the next mile we counted 6 more hanging forms by the blaze of the lightning, and altogether it was a grisly excursion. That murmur was a murmur no longer. It was a roar of men's voices. A man came flying by now, dimly through the darkness, and other men chasing him. They disappeared. Presently another case of the kind occurred, and then another, and another. Then a sudden turn of the road brought us in sight of that fire. It was a large manor house, and little or nothing was left of it. And everywhere men were flying, and other men raging after them in pursuit. I warned the king that this was not a safe place for strangers. We would better get away from the light until matters should improve. We stepped back a little, and hid in the edge of the wood. From this hiding place we saw both men and women hunted by the mob. The fearful work went on until nearly dawn. Then, the fire being out and the storm spent, the voices and flying footsteps presently ceased, and darkness and stillness reigned again. We ventured out and hurried cautiously away, and although we were worn out and sleepy, we kept on until we had put this place some miles behind us. Then we asked hospitably at the hut of a charcoal burner and got what was to be had. A woman was up and about, but the man was still asleep on a straw shakedown on the clay floor. The woman seemed uneasy until I explained that we were travelers and had lost our way and been wandering in the woods all night. She became talkative then and asked if we had heard of the terrible goings-on at the manor house of Ablasur. Yes, we had heard of them, but what we wanted now was rest and sleep. The king broke in, "Sell us the house and take yourselves away, for we be perilous company, being late come from people that died of the spotted death." It was good of him, but unnecessary. One of the commonest decorations of the nation was the waffle-iron face. I had early noticed that the woman and her husband were both so decorated. She made us entirely welcome and had no fears, and plainly she was immensely impressed by the king's proposition, for, of course, it was a good deal of an event in her life to run across a person of the king's humble appearance who was ready to buy a man's house for the sake of a night's lodging. It gave her a large respect for us, and she strained the lean possibilities of her hovel to the utmost to make us comfortable. We slept till far into the afternoon, and then got up hungry enough to make cotter fare quite palatable to the king, the more particularly as it was scant in quantity, and also in variety. It consisted solely of onions, salt, and the national black bread made out of horse feed. The woman told us about the affair the evening before. At 10 or 11 at night, when everybody was in bed, the manor house burnt into flames. The countryside swarmed to the rescue, and the family were saved, with one exception, the master. He did not appear. Everybody was frantic over this loss, and 2 brave yeomen sacrificed their lives in ransacking the burning house seeking that valuable personage. But after a while he was found, what was left of him, which was his corpse. It was in a copse 300 yards away, bound, gagged, stabbed in a dozen places. Who had done this? Suspicion fell upon a humble family in the neighborhood who had been lately treated with particular harshness by the baron, and from these people the suspicion easily extended itself to their relatives and familiars. A suspicion was enough. My lord's liveried retainers proclaimed an instant crusade against these people, and were promptly joined by the community in general. The woman's husband had been active with the mob, and had not returned home until nearly dawn. He was gone now to find out what the general result had been. While we were still talking, he came back from his quest. His report was revolting enough. 18 persons hanged or butchered, and 2 yeomen and 13 prisoners lost in the fire. And how many prisoners were there altogether in the vaults? 13. Then every one of them was lost? Yes, all. But the people arrived in time to save the family. How is it they could save none of the prisoners? The man looked puzzled and said, Would one unlock the vaults at such a time? Marry, some would have escaped. Then you mean that nobody did unlock them? None went near them, either to lock or unlock. It standeth to reason that the bolts were fast, wherefore it was only needful to establish a watch, so that if any broke the bonds he might not escape but be taken. None were taken. Nathless, 3 did escape, said the king, and ye will do well to publish it and set justice upon their track, for these murdered the baron and fired the house. I was just expecting he would come out with that. For a moment the man and his wife showed an eager interest in this news and an impatience to go out and spread it. Then a sudden something else betrayed itself in their faces, and they began to ask questions. I answered the questions myself and narrowly watched the effects produced. I was soon satisfied that the knowledge of who these 3 prisoners were had somehow changed the atmosphere. That our host's continued eagerness to go and spread the news was now only pretended and not real. The king did not notice the change, and I was glad of that. I worked the conversation around toward other details of the night's proceedings, and noted that these people were relieved to have it take that direction. The painful thing observable about all this business was the alacrity with which this oppressed community had turned their cruel hands against their own class in the interest of the common oppressor. This man and woman seemed to feel that in a quarrel between a person of their own class and his lord, it was the natural and proper and rightful thing for that poor devil's whole caste to side with the master and fight his battle for him, without ever stopping to inquire into the rights or wrongs of the matter. This man had been out helping to hang his neighbors, and had done his work with zeal, and yet was aware that there was nothing against them but a mere suspicion, with nothing back of it describable as evidence. Still, neither he nor his wife seemed to see anything horrible about it. This was depressing to a man with the dream of a republic in his head. It reminded me of a time 13 centuries away when the poor whites of our South, who were always despised and frequently insulted by the slave lords around them, and who owed their base condition simply to the presence of slavery in their midst, were yet pusillanimously ready to side with the slave lords in all political moves for the upholding and perpetuating of slavery, and did also finally shoulder their muskets and pour out their lives in an effort to prevent the destruction of that very institution which degraded them. And there was only one redeeming feature connected with that pitiful piece of history, and that was that secretly the poor white did detest the slave lord and did feel his own shame. That feeling was not brought to the surface, but the fact that it was there and could have been brought out, under favoring circumstances, was something. In fact, it was enough, for it showed that a man is at bottom a man, after all, even if it doesn't show on the outside. Well, as it turned out, this charcoal burner was just the twin of the southern poor white of the far future. The king presently showed impatience and said, "And ye prattle here all the day, justice will miscarry. Think ye the criminals will abide in their father's house? They are fleeing. They are not waiting. Ye should look to it that a party of horse be set upon their track." The woman paled slightly, but quite perceptibly, and the man looked flustered and irresolute. I said, "Come, friend, I will walk a little way with you, and explain which direction I think they would try to take. If they were merely resisters of the Gabelle, or some kindred absurdity, I would try to protect them from capture. But when men murder a person of high degree and likewise burn his house, that is another matter." The last remark was for the king to quiet him. On the road the man pulled his resolution together and began the march with a steady gait, but there was no eagerness in it. By and by I said, "What relation were these men to you? Cousins?" He turned as white as his layer of charcoal would let him and stopped, trembling. "Ah, my God, how know ye that?" "I didn't know it. It was a chance guess." "Poor lads, they are lost, and good lads they were, too. Were you actually going yonder to tell on them?" He didn't quite know how to take that, but he said hesitatingly, "Yes." "Then I think you are a damned scoundrel." It made him as glad as if I had called him an angel. Say the good words again, brother, for surely you mean that you would not betray me, and I failed of my duty.
Duty? There's no duty in the matter except the duty to keep still and let those men get away. They've done a righteous deed.
He looked pleased, pleased and touched with apprehension at the same time. He looked up and down the road to see that no one was coming, and then said in a cautious voice,
"From what land come you, brother, that you speak such perilous words and seem not to be afraid?"
"They are not perilous words when spoken to one of my own caste, I take it. You would not tell anybody I said them."
I would be drawn asunder by wild horses first.
Well, then, let me say my say. I have no fears of your repeating it. I think the devil's work has been done last night upon those innocent poor people. That old baron got only what he deserved. If I had my way, all his kind should have the same luck.
Fear and depression vanished from the man's manner, and gratefulness and a brave animation took their place.
Even though you be a spy, and your words a trap for my undoing, yet are they such refreshment that to hear them again, and others like to them, I would go to the gallows happy, as having had one good feast at least in a starved life. And I will say my say now, and ye may report it, if ye be so minded. I helped to hang my neighbors, for that it were peril to my own life to show lack of zeal in the master's cause. The others helped for none other reason. All rejoice today that he is dead, but all do go about seemingly sorrowing and shedding the hypocrite's tear, for in that lies safety. I have said the words, I have said the words, the only ones that have ever tasted good in my mouth, and the reward of that taste is sufficient. Lead on, and you will, be it even to the scaffold, for I am ready. There it was, you see, a man is a man at bottom. Whole ages of abuse and oppression cannot crush the manhood clear out of him. Whoever thinks it a mistake is himself mistaken. Yes, there is plenty good enough material for a republic in the most degraded people that ever existed, even the Russians, plenty of manhood in them, even in the Germans, if one could but force it out of its timid and suspicious privacy to overthrow and trample in the mud any throne that ever was set up and any nobility that ever supported it. We should see certain things yet, let us hope and believe. First, a modified monarchy, till Arthur's days were done. Then the destruction of the throne, nobility abolished, every member of it bound out to some useful trade, universal suffrage instituted, and the whole government placed in the hands of the men and women of the nation there to remain. Yes, there was no occasion to give up my dream yet a while. End of chapter 30.
So we kind of returned to classic Twain humor at the end. But, you know, the crack about the Russians and the Germans is interesting because he's writing this, like I said, during the Gilded Age in the States, but it's still pretty Victorian everywhere else. And part of that means that the children and grandchildren of Victoria are now, historically speaking, setting themselves up to be the children who didn't play well together and who will eventually start World War I. So it's important to remember that the crack about Russians still having a lot of manhood in them isn't so much a crack. The people were pretty badly treated under the Tsars, and it's just an interesting statement to find in the middle of a Mark Twain humor novel. So that's it. I hope you have a great week. I hope I have a great week too, and I will be back next week with the next two chapters of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Have a great one. Bye.
Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And Knit Circus online magazine, offering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the fall issue at www.knitcircus.com. And Scribe Tutor, the online writing tutor offering personalized and convenient writing help for all ages. You can find more about Scribe Tutor at scribetutor.com. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. the show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.